Why do some countries advance while others fall behind? Who benefits from economic growth and who doesn't? How do inequality and climate change affect people, especially the most marginalized? And what role can data play in answering questions like these and informing policies that promote economic justice? Let's find out on Voices in Development. Hello and welcome to our podcast. I'm your host, Catherine Cheney. We're coming to you from the Economic Growth Center at Yale University, which is focused on economics and data-driven insights for equitable development. Today, we're going to be speaking with Lauren Falcao-Berquist. Lauren is an assistant professor of economics and global affairs at Yale University. She studies agricultural markets and firms in sub-Saharan Africa. A lot of Lauren's work uses randomized control trials to measure the effectiveness of interventions. In this conversation, we'll explore the unique approach she takes to her research, combining experimental methods and economic theory, a lot of the questions that drive her evaluations, and how she's worked to convey some of her findings to policymakers. Lauren will share how she ended up on this path, learnings from her research so far, particularly around how to get food from where it is to where it needs to be and when it is needed, and also what brought her to Yale. Lauren, welcome to Voices in Development. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So there seems to be growing public awareness around the issue of global food security. Can you expand on the connection between your work and some of these challenges like food prices and food shortages globally?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the way I like to think about it is sort of two issues. One is, you know, are individual countries producing enough food? And the second is distribution. Is the food getting where it needs to be? So on the first issue of, you know, producing enough food, that's where you think about issues around climate change. I work a lot in East Africa, in Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, Ethiopia. They've had what are called sort of historic droughts, but for the past 5 years every year. So that's a huge issue. And then you layer on top of that the distributional issues. And this is where issues like conflict, like the war in Ukraine, come into play. You know, Amartya Sen once, who's a famous economist and philosopher, once said, you know, there's no famine in democracies. And the idea there is basically it's not just about the production of food. It's about getting food where it needs to be. And government institutions or conflict can really come into play in terms of preventing food from getting where it needs to be. So the war in Ukraine is one of those issues. So all these issues around, I think, you know, both is there enough food being produced and then distributionally, is it getting where it needs to be, are both really important. I'll say, you know, economists are sort of working on both issues. There's lots of economists thinking about, you know, not the agronomy of how you grow more food, but thinking about how farmers behave in terms of what are the barriers that stop them from using all the tools they can use to increase their yield. So, you know, there's, for example, fertilizer, improved seeds that historically a lot of smallholder farmers in East Africa have not used those technologies. So a lot of work on sort of why is there low adoption of these seemingly profitable technologies. And then my work is much more on the second question, distributionally. So how can we get food from areas of surplus to areas of deficit, from times of plenty to times, of the lean season, times of need? So my work is much more on the second issue, but there are economists involved in both.
I'd love to hear about some of the key moments that led you down a path to where you are today. And specifically, I read about a summer you spent in East Africa before your senior year of college that was particularly influential for you. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so I spent a summer in Tanzania, summer after my junior year in college, and I was working with a nonprofit there that essentially takes college-age volunteers, places them in a homestay, and then they're working in the village to basically promote sort of HIV and AIDS education. So did a lot of sort of teaching in primary schools about HIV prevention, had other campaigns and the like. On a personal note, it was totally transformative. I had actually barely left the country, the U.S., before. And so living in a rural village in Tanzania was a totally, you know, eye-opening experience about the rest of the world. It's where I started learning Swahili. I became very close with sort of my homestay parents. I just sort of fell in love with the place and the culture, and I've worked there ever since. So on a personal note, it's been totally transformative. And it really helped launch sort of my interest in the region. But I worried, you know, even at the time, I worried, though there were such good intentions for this NGO, this program, you know, everyone had spent a lot of time and money to fly to the area to prepare materials, to think about, you know, trainings and the like, it wasn't clear to me what sort of impact we were actually having on the communities we were there to serve. And it got me thinking, like, is this the best bang for the buck in terms of, you know, was it really worth the thousands of dollars of the plane flight, for example, to come here? Is that the best use of these funds? And so it got me thinking about issues around basically development and efficacy. What works? What's the best bang for your buck? And that's really motivated me into a life of research. Lots of people have very good intentions, but how do we know what really works and how do we funnel those good intentions into actual outcomes?
So what were the next steps you took to pursue some of those questions and turn that pursuit into a career?
After college, had a couple jobs. One of them that was very influential was I worked as a research assistant for Ted Miguel, who's a professor at UC Berkeley. He started an organization called CIGA, which is the Center for Effective Global Action. And it's basically a network of researchers like Ted, like now myself, who are doing work in this space. And it gave me a chance to, you know, I worked on some of the projects. So I was able to work, for example, on a project in Kenya looking at the long-run impact of a school-based deworming campaign. So treating children for intestinal parasites and worms and looking at kind of the long-run impact that had on their educational attainment and eventual labor market outcomes. And it really gave me sort of a sense of what it means to actually be doing the work in this space. You know, I had learned a little bit as an undergrad academically about what some of these studies looked like. And then, of course, when I went to grad school, I learned a lot more. But it was really some of that time in the field that gave me a sense of it's really sort of an entrepreneurial endeavor. You're hiring staff members, you're running big surveys, you are often working very closely with implementing partners, be it NGOs or governments, to help actually in some ways often think about sort of how to roll out their program in a way that it can be evaluated. So you're very kind of entrenched in the programmatic details. I spent a lot of time doing focus groups, a lot of qualitative work, all these things that don't actually really pop up in our papers, but I think are really critical to, one, doing good research, but two, really understanding the community and context in which you're working.
And that's a good point that a lot of this qualitative work doesn't actually appear in your research in what we would read. So can you tell us more about that? I mean, I'd love to hear, you mentioned how that summer you spent in Tanzania was so transformative for you personally in terms of your interest in Swahili, your interest in the region. Can you tell us about some of that qualitative work you did in some of your early work in development economics that, you know, convinced you this is the path you wanted to continue to pursue?
One of the summers during grad school, I spent about 3 months working in Kenya. I spent a lot of time in Kenya during grad school. And one of the first summers I spent there, I spent talking to agricultural traders or intermediaries. So these are folks who will go to rural farms, they will buy from individual farmers, and they will then bring to markets and sell to customers. And sometimes there's sort of multiple layers of these traders, but that's roughly what they do. And I had gone in to talk to them about one thing, which was I had previous work on looking at sort of seasonal price fluctuations, and there was sort of this question as to why traders who are private businessmen who have sort of working capital, why they're not basically arbitraging this seasonal price fluctuation and storing commodities that are storable. So I'd gone to talk to them about that, but these conversations sort of go in all these different directions. And one of the things these traders were telling me is, yeah, they could do that sort of business, arbitraging, storing, but they made so much more money doing their regular business. And I started really getting into the math of, you know, how much profits are they making? What are they doing? They would, you know, it's fun. A lot of them would sort of, a lot of them don't keep records, but they would write down the math, often taking a pen to their hand and actually writing down numbers about how many bags they were selling and what their markup was per bag. And it just seemed like they were making very large profits. And it got me thinking a little bit about kind of the market structure and how competitive were these markets, because there had been these massive reforms in these markets in the 80s and 90s to liberalize them, to really try to exploit the private sector to, again, effectively sort of move crops from surplus to deficit areas. But of course, you know, for those markets to work sort of efficiently, it has to be that they're closer to competitive than non-competitive. And it seemed like these guys are making large profits. And there could be a bunch of reasons for that. But one thing I looked at was sort of, does it look like their behavior is collusive? And it was interesting talking to folks. There is sort of a public perception that these traders are colluding and exploiting. And actually, my impression was probably as an economist, they're not. They're there for a reason. They're filling some role. They have some advantages in terms of knowing who's selling, who's buying. You know, they can really fill a role. And maybe they're just but it's costly to be a trader. And maybe this is just their cost. But it seemed like they were actually, upon talking to them, making large profits. And I asked them explicitly. I said, you know, are you colluding? And I would say the typical trader said no. They sort of, I think, knew the right answer was no. But usually within a single market, at least one trader would tell me, yes, we have some price agreement. So it was just, you know, talking to them a lot, really understanding their business, gaining trust also to kind of be honest about some of these things, really gave me a lot of insight into how their business models work. And then, of course, the research I did after that was much more than just this is what traders say. But I thought that was very helpful in giving sort of a gut check on how do these markets work? Do they feel like they're competitive or not? What is kind of the business proposition that these traders see?
So a question on that research, if I'm not mistaken, I believe this is the work you did where some of your takeaways were actually different from the stance of policymakers on the issue, and you had to sort of relay that to policymakers, which I think is fascinating because, you know, speaking of trust and the importance of relationships in this work, you obviously want your research to yield policy insights. That's a great outcome, but it's probably something you need to handle delicately. So can you just talk us through that?
That's exactly right. And so just to flesh out sort of what the unexpected policy implications were, you know, we did a research study, which I'm happy to describe, which basically found that it did look like these traders were colluding. One possible policy remedy that I think a lot of policymakers jump to is, oh, these are, you know, they're all bad actors. They're exploiting farmers, they're exploiting consumers, let's just cut them out entirely. And in fact, the policy recommendations out of that paper and subsequent work of mine is actually the answer is not to cut them out, right? I mean, first of all, there used to be an environment with much fewer intermediaries where the state really ran things. That was sort of the regime during the 80s and 90s, and that did not go terribly well. The state is also not very good. Governments are also not very good about knowing what prices to set. There also can be corruption within governments as well. In fact, it seemed like the answer was not to cut out intermediaries, but actually to make it easier for intermediaries to do their work and to expand their business. So one thing that we found in this study is we actually incentivized traders to enter new markets that they hadn't worked in before. We basically covered the cost of going to a new market. And we found that, you know, when existing traders who already knew, you know, if they're already buddies with the other traders in the marketplace, then bringing in someone new didn't really help. If they really knew the existing folk, you know, they didn't break basically the price agreement. At least that's what the data sort of tell us. But if they don't have contacts in the existing market, if they're really sort of new on a social, you know, socially to the other traders, then they come in and they do actually start undercutting the existing traders and sort of bringing prices more towards a competitive price. And so actually my takeaway from this study is we need to find a way to, you know, get new folks into these markets. This all inspired sort of work in Uganda now where we're working on essentially a technology that's sort of like an eBay or an Alibaba, but it's designed to make it easier for buyers and sellers to find each other, including traders, to meet who don't know each other already. So to kind of break out of these somewhat collusive social network-based trading arrangements. So anyway, the policy punchline is like this idea of don't cut out intermediaries, make it easier for them actually to do their business and to enter new markets. And that's sort of maybe counterintuitive to what a lot of policymakers might have thought.
So you just mentioned the policy punchline. I mean, how do you then translate that to policymakers? Is it publish the findings and hope they come across it, or were meetings involved? I'd just love to hear more about that translation from research to policy.
Yeah, and I'll be frank, I think this is one place that we still really struggle as economists in translating the work. You know, I think in some other disciplines, you know, in some of the harder sciences or engineering, people go out and they start their own business and they really sort of inject their research discovery into the world. I think economists sometimes, especially development economists, sometimes struggle. I think, frankly, the most successful cases I've seen of translating your research into policy is when the research has started off with policymakers sort of already built in as stakeholders, whether it's evaluating a project that government is running or having it be sort of demand-driven research where they've a minister of such and such has asked for research on this topic. I didn't have that in my case, and so it's much more difficult to kind of, yes, of course you publish, and the other you know, 30 economists who do what I do, maybe read the paper, that might be generous to how many people read the paper. And you do, of course, like we write policy briefs, there's blog posts that we write, there's policy briefs. And then, yes, you try to set up meetings, basically. But I think doing it after the fact can be a real challenge. I work very closely with one organization called the International Growth Center, which is based out of LSE in London, but has country offices in many countries around the world. I work most closely with the Rwanda and Uganda offices. I'm the lead academic for the Rwanda office. And they do a really fantastic job of actually embedding what they call country economists into countries. They're not necessarily sitting, you know, in the ministries, but they're very close to that. So they're having really regular policy meetings, and they're trying to basically kind of be that bridge between what is it the policymakers want to learn about and academic researchers. And so I've been involved both in kind of matchmaking for other researchers and in starting some new projects of my own. And so finding that sweet spot between academically interesting, but it's something that policymakers demanded. That's where I think that that's actually the best way. Otherwise, the after the fact, you do a presentation, you write a paper, you know, I think it can have a big academic impact, but I think it's harder to get policymakers' ear that way.
So earlier you mentioned your work in Uganda, and I believe this is with Kudu, this agricultural mobile marketplace. Can you expand on that work and tell us how it connects with some of your other research?
The whole idea of sort of e-commerce, in this case maybe e-commerce light, is really taking off, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, where mobile phones have become really ubiquitous in many countries. I mean, they've really leapfrogged over. No one ever had and no one's ever going to have landlines in many of these contexts. When you get cell phone penetration of 50%, 60%, you know, Kenya has, I haven't checked it recently, but I think it's like upwards of 75 or 80%. When you get that kind of cell phone penetration, you start thinking, are there ways we can use this network of people and contacts to help facilitate commerce? So that project is really, again, motivated because this broad question of how do we get crops where they need to go from areas of surplus to deficit. And, you know, one of the issues in making these markets work effectively is that it's simply hard for buyers and sellers to find each other. I mean, it's why intermediaries exist in the first place, is that an individual tiny farmer in a rural area is not going to, you know, is going to have a hard time kind of matching with and finding a big buyer in Kampala. And so a lot of these platforms have come out to say, is there a way to basically on your cell phone, and these are not smartphones, these are very simple, you know, think of kind of the old brick Nokia phone, you know, feature phones. Is there a way to basically text in or use the platform to say, hey, I'm looking to sell this amount of maize at this price, I'm in this location. Have buyers do the same thing. Hey, I'm a buyer. I'm looking for this price. I'm in this location. And basically do some matchmaking and make it easier for people to find each other. And so that's what Kudu does. Again, it's works on very simple feature phones. It was founded by a pretty neat partnership between a computer scientist at the largest university in Uganda called Makerere and computer scientists at Microsoft Research, along with other places. And so it's this pretty neat partnership, and they developed basically the platform, and we worked with them to roll it out. They were sort of budget constrained. They could only roll out in a certain number of communities, and we partnered with them to say, hey, can we randomize where we roll out? And one thing from a sort of academic perspective that's pretty neat about this rollout is it's a really oftentimes these randomized control trials where you have sort of a treatment and a control group and you compare differences in outcomes between the two, it's very common to kind of do those trials at an individual level. So think about, for example, you know, even the recent COVID vaccine, right? So they've got people in the treatment group, people in the control group, the treatment group gets the vaccine. And then you compare kind of, you know, who gets COVID. In this case, we want to look at impacts on what happens to market prices and trade flows. And so we can't just randomize individuals into, you know, getting kudu or not. We want to really randomize at a very high level. So in this case, we looked at the sub-county level in Uganda, which has about 50,000 people per sub-county. And we said this whole sub-county is going to be encouraged to use kudu. We're going to fund promotional campaigns in these areas, really encourage these areas to get on. And we're going to compare in this entire sub-county, you know, what happens to their trade flows and prices. I'll tell you the positive and the negative. So the positive is traders really use the platform quite a bit, and we see impacts that you would hope to see on market efficiency. So what I mean by that is basically people use the platform, and what we see happening is that, you know, markets or sub-counties that are exposed to or using Kudu, they trade more with each other, see more traders kind of actively trading between these areas, you see trade flows go up, you see price dispersion go down, meaning the gap in prices across areas. So specifically, you know, Econ 101 in areas that are typically surplus areas that have a lot of crops, the prices are typically low. And in those places, we see prices go up as crops are moved out of those areas. So farmers are better off in those areas. And in deficit areas where prices, you know, supply is typically low and therefore prices are typically high, in those areas, as Kudu brings crops in on the food security side, we see prices go down. That's going to help consumers. So sort of the, you know, the basic Econ 101 things you would hope happen do seem to happen. So it does seem to sort of be getting crops from surplus to deficit areas more efficiently. So that's sort of a big win. The negative side is I think that a lot of the folks who promote these platforms, you know, I kind of told you a story of like an individual smallholder farmer in a rural area is directly going to connect to a big buyer in the capital city. That doesn't really happen. So it's the users are not really individual tiny farmers, as I think often is the hope, but it's the traders again. So again, not cutting out the intermediaries, right? I mean, it's really sort of using them to say, okay, you guys are the ones who have the scale to actually use this platform effectively, but do your trade more efficiently with this platform.
So in addition to Kudu, I know another one of your collaborations has been with One Acre Fund, a social enterprise serving smallholder farmers in East Africa, and that this work looks at loans for maize storage. Can you tell us more about that process and your findings?
Sure. The work I've been talking about thus far is really about sort of getting crops from areas, geographic areas of surplus to areas of deficit, but there's also a time dimension as well. So if you look at sort of prices across major markets, so, you know, capital city markets in East Africa and really around most of the world and the developing world, you'll see that prices follow a really seasonal trend for food prices. So right after harvest, surplus is high, prices tend to be really low. And then over the course of the season, as that supply sort of dries up, you'll see prices go up. In Kenya, they call the lean season the hunger season. People literally, prices are so high, people literally go hungry. And then they fall again rapidly when the next harvest comes. So there's a cyclical pattern. Now, what's sort of puzzling to an economist is that this is for crops often that are fairly storable. So we're looking at maize or corn, which, you know, there are some post-harvest losses that can happen, but it's basically, you can basically put it into a bag, put some insecticide dust on it after it's been properly dried and store it in your home. And so the puzzle is, you know, why are they selling right after harvest time? Why don't they store it in their home or in some location and then basically sell once prices are higher? And we're talking about qualitative work before. So we spent basically a whole summer doing farmer interviews and farmer focus groups. And the answer that came up time and time again is there are a lot of bills that come due right around harvest time. So one of the big ones is school fees come due right after harvest, but also lots of bills are sort of timed to come when farmers are harvesting. And the challenge that these farmers often don't have anywhere else to turn to pay these bills besides selling their crops. You know, they don't really have access to sort of formal bank loans. And so if they want to pay their kids' school fees, they have to sell sort of at the time the school fees are due, which is right after harvest. So they knew it wasn't like, you know, I think one of the good things about doing qualitative work and about being an economist in general is I think you can, you know, there's a little bit of a humility that comes along with it. Of like, it wasn't like these people didn't know the prices. They didn't like, you know, they knew how to do the math. They knew it was good to sell later, but they just couldn't because they were credit constrained. It's sort of the, you know, econ speak way for talking about what was going on here. They were credit constrained. They couldn't access loans and they had to do this thing that was sort of less profitable. So we were doing these focus groups, you know, with One Acre Fund, and they came up with a new product basically, which would be a loan that they would give farmers in the area that farmers could then use that loan to store their maize, meaning they could basically use that loan to pay school fees and other bills that would enable them to not sell right away and sell later on when it was more profitable. And so we, again, a lot of why I do these randomized controlled trials, you know, One Acre Fund had a certain amount of cash or working capital they could give out in loans, and they kindly allowed us to say, you know, among the kind of target population population they're hoping to serve. There's many more people they'd like to serve than they can. They allowed us to randomize which farmers received the loan. And so first of all, you know, there's some great things that come out of it. So the loan seems to work. Farmers do store more as a result. They do earn higher revenues. So it seems like this is, you know, a good way to enable farmers to make more from their, you know, given their harvest. The other thing we did that I think is particularly neat about this project is we did more than just randomize the loan across individuals. We also, at a higher geographic level, so in Kenya it's called a sublocation. It's basically a couple of villages put together. At the sublocation level, we randomized how many farmers got the loan. So in some sublocations, lots of farmers got the loan, and in some sublocations, only a small number. And that allowed us to say, what happens in an entire community or sort of economy when lots of people are getting this loan product? And what we found is actually when lots of people are getting this loan and lots of people are storing, you actually see, because sort of on net, lots of crops are moving from being sold at harvest to being sold in the lean season, you actually start to see smoother prices, right? So higher prices at harvest, and they typically are low, and lower prices in the lean season. And that actually, you know, has two impacts. One is that for borrowers, it's not so great. So if you're borrowing to do arbitrage, you know, if you're arbitraging, you sort of want to be the only one who's figured out the trick. You want to be the only one arbitraging. So it actually made storing a little bit less profitable for folks in that area, still profitable, but a little less. But for everyone else in the community, we have some suggestive evidence that it looks like others benefited. So even if you're not storing, you're still selling at harvest time, you're going to benefit from there being slightly higher prices at harvest. And many of these farmers actually run out of their own stores and go back to buy in the lean season. So they also benefit on the other end from lower prices in the lean season. So at sort of a community level, it's actually really beneficial. It just, the gains sort of move from private gains to public gains, kind of benefiting even non-borrowers. And that has implications for, you know, whether banks can make money with these kind of lending products and the like. So it's sort of additional rationale for groups like One-Acre Fund or governments to try to think about subsidizing some of these loans.
Really interesting. There's definitely a connection between each of these projects. I think it may speak to why you've sort of narrowed in on agricultural markets over the course of your career thus far. So can you talk about that? What are the factors that draw you to this work on agricultural markets, and what connects these projects?
Two things. One is, you know, on a fundamental level, there's not much more important than food markets. And that's, I guess, you know, on sort of both sides of the market. So if you think about kind of the typical poor households in low and middle income countries, it's, you know, typically farmers. So the vast majority of the poor are living in rural areas, working in agriculture, and these crops are sort of their livelihood. So it's really about livelihood. And on the flip side, for consumers, it's about food consumption. And a lot of my work so far is focused on really staple commodities, so sort of the biggest portion of the diet of the poorest households. So in terms of, you know, human welfare, both on the livelihood side and on the food security side, this is just critical. So I think from a welfare perspective, this just struck me as an incredibly important topic to be working on. And then, you know, the nerd in me on the second side, the nerd in me really loves the econ here. It's really, in some ways, it's sort of straightforward kind of econ 101 I mentioned before. You know, it's sort of what happens when supply is high or supply is low. But it really nicely ties in some, I think, pretty basic economic intuition into what you should expect from these programs. And so that's been really fun to feel like, you know, using your comparative advantage as an economist to try to think about or frame these issues, even in a very basic way, in terms of the economics at play, I think has been a lot of fun as well.
I know that your approach is unique, combining experimental methods and economic theory. So can you tell us a little bit more about your approach?
I've been talking a lot about the importance of measuring the efficacy of a particular program, and I think that's key. But I guess as an academic researcher, one thing that I think distinguishes kind of academic work is it's meant to be a little more sort of basic science and understanding something sort of deeper, more fundamental about these markets and kind of the what are the market failures or things that are kind of fundamentally leading to poverty or perpetuating poverty. And so I think sometimes bringing in theory can help understand the deeper issues at play. So just as one example, you know, the work on understanding how competitive you know, what was the behavior of these traders? Was it sort of competitive or collusive? In Kenya, you know, we did something sort of funny but very tied to theory, which is we basically gave traders in a market a subsidy per bag they were selling to customers. And we just measured how much of that subsidy did they pass on to consumers. So, you know, when we gave them a 200 shilling reduction in price, did they actually give customers a 200 shilling reduction in price, or was it something much less? And you can use basically economic theory to think about, well, how much would they give if they were in, you know, really competing with each other? The kind of basic intuition is, you know, probably most of it, versus how much would they give if they were colluding with each other, which is, you know, potentially they'd give much less. And then we found basically what do? They don't actually pass on very much to consumers. And we can basically, through theory, say that looks like it's pretty consistent with what we'd expect them to do if they were colluding. And it really, for me, you know, I think, again, policymakers have often had this rhetoric around, are traders collusive, are they not? You can talk to them. It's hard to know if you're getting a straight answer. You can try to directly measure profits in surveys, but it's very difficult. I mentioned they don't keep records. So to me, it felt like doing an experiment, but combining it with theory of what should you expect under these two different economic theories helped, I hope, to answer a question that otherwise was sort of difficult to answer just by talking to people. So that's one thing, is kind of the basic science. The other thing is, even if you want to measure the efficacy of a single program, it's often useful to bring in theory. So I mentioned this project in Uganda, where we randomized at a really high level so we can see what happens to prices and trade flows and all that. But even randomizing at this sub-county level that has 50,000 people per sub-county in Uganda, you know, these sub-counties aren't an autarky, which basically means, you know, they're not an island, not trading with anyone else. And so it's possible that markets, even that didn't get kudu, still are affected in some way as prices and trade flows start to kind of shift around the entire country. And so there are particular economic models, often coming from trade theory, that can help us to think about how do we account for some of these things that are happening at kind of an aggregate level and try to measure kind of the total impact, even when we think potentially our control group is sort of, you know, affected by the intervention. So when you think about also evaluating policies at scale, even particular policies, but what will happen when you really offer it to everyone, it's often valuable to bring in theory. So that's another sort of place, a direction that I'm going with my work, is trying to think about merging experiments and theory to think about how can we go from a very small pilot and seeing what happens there to kind of projecting what would happen if we actually offered this program everywhere.
I wonder what other questions you're looking to explore in your research. You know, is this a space that you're going to remain in? And if so, what big questions do you have? Or are there other interventions you're interested in exploring over time?
Yeah, it's sort of funny. I feel like my research agenda has sort of followed like the path to development most folks think of. So I've worked so far in kind of staple commodities. So staple commodities, those are things like maize, corn, or wheat. So they're basic, often grains or cereals that the poor are basically getting most of the majority of their calories from. I am starting to move into some more sort of export-oriented commodities. Export-oriented commodities are commodities that are destined for international markets. So if you think in the agricultural space, that's often things like coffee, tea, sometimes horticulture, meaning sort of vegetables and fruits. And these are places where quality dimensions really tend to matter. I've got a project right now on coffee in Uganda looking at, you know, how can we basically improve the quality of the coffee that Uganda exports. And I'm potentially starting some new stuff working with manufacturing firms in Rwanda. You know, I think of myself working as sort of in agricultural markets, but also in firms, and I'm starting to kind of move up the value chain and thinking about quality issues. A value chain is sort of the full spectrum of starting from the very original producer down to the consumer. And there's often intermediaries in between who are either processing the good or connecting buyers and sellers, which, you know, are relevant and present for staple commodities, but are much more about sort of basic consumption, not a lot of questions around quality, to if you want to actually export to and reach international markets where people really are willing to pay for much more for higher quality products, you have to think about what are the barriers to low and middle income countries in terms of producing that quality product that's demanded. So some of my new work is starting to think about some of that quality dimension as well.
And last question for you, just have to ask in our limited time together. I know you're new to Yale, and I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about what drew you to Yale and what things we should look out for in terms of your upcoming research.
Yeah, so I think there's sort of two threads of my work that we've actually already touched on that I think Yale is just particularly strong in. So it's really been a pleasure to sort of be around world-class, you know, scholars who are working in this field that's of interest to me. So one is this idea of sort of combining experiments and theories. You know, Yale is really top-notch in terms of development economics, but it has a particular focus on taking theory and economics really seriously, and even among folks who are doing sort of experimental work, really bringing that theory in. So that's been really fun to be around folks who have kind of a similar methodological approach. The other thing is this question of how program impacts change at scale. So when you scale up a program and prices start to change and trade flows start to change, what happens? And there's actually an initiative started by Mushfiq Mubarak, who is at the School of Management and the Econ Department here, called Why Rise. That's really focused on this exact question about what happens to programs when you scale them. And it's critical because it's you talked about before, kind of translating our research into policy. You know, I think going from these small scale pilots that academics often run to thinking about answering the policy relevant question of a government is thinking about rolling out a national program, what is this going to do and what is it going to look like? You know, this question about how program impacts change at scale is really critical to getting that conversation right, to really having kind of the right numbers in terms of the efficacy and the full impact that policymakers want. So it's really fun to be at a place that's, you know, Yale has as an institution invested in this sort of scaling agenda, which is a personal real passion of mine. So it's been really fun to be at a place that values that and is very interested in supporting that research.
Thank you. Well, really excited to continue to follow your research at Yale and beyond. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Before we go, Aishwarya Lakshmi Ratan, Deputy Director at Yale's Economic Growth Center, is joining us to share more on what's happening at EGC. Aishwarya?
Thanks, Catherine. As Lauren mentioned in this episode, other EGC affiliates are looking at these same subjects using different lenses and in different countries. For work that takes a macro look at agriculture, food insecurity, and poverty, I direct listeners to a recent paper by Mark Rosenzweig and Andrew Foster that concludes that there are actually too many small farms in the world. So I think we need to think a bit carefully about optimal scale in agriculture and inclusive processes and institutions that will allow millions of smallholder farmers to realize gains in agricultural output that can be sustainably achieved, but also that will help drive poverty reduction in low-income countries. For a very different look at how access to markets affects earnings, please take a look at Kevin Donovan's collaboration with an NGO that builds footbridges. And this gives villagers in both Sub-Saharan Africa and in Latin America better access to local markets. Finally, for those who are interested in catching up on the latest research from EGC and across the field in, you know, areas such as markets, supply chains, agriculture, EGC hosted the NUDC conference in November 2022. Our website has a write-up of the event and links to dozens of new papers. This is, you know, one of the major annual development economics forums, and it alternates among the consortium members. It was really our pleasure to host everyone this year, and I hope everyone has a chance to look at this very rich content and set of new research in these areas.
Thanks, Aishwarya. That's all we have time for in this episode of Voices in Development. If you'd like to learn more about the Economic Growth Center, you can visit the website at egc.yale.edu and look for the next installment of Voices in Development on EGC's website or on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.